Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Lifetime Original Podcast.
This episode covers topics that include murder and violence. Listener discretion is advised. Everyone report to the ship deck.
Everybody report to the ship deck. We have an important announcement. Quinn, who shares this announcement? God, let's be really mysterious about it. Not reveal it. Keep it a little suspenseful.
No, we wouldn't do that to you.
We'll tell him. We have some bummer news that we want to share with you. And don't worry, we have good news after. But sadly, Crime of a Lifetime will be powering
down. Closing its doors.
Yes. We have three more episodes, so including this one, two more after this. So don't worry, we won't leave you completely hanging.
Unless our last episode features a hanging.
And that is a really big caveat. And I want to be very clear. This won't be the last time you hear from Carrie and Quinn, but it is going to be sort of the end of this iteration of Carrie and Quinn on Crime of a Lifetime. All of the wonderful people we've worked with, all of the wonderful podcasts that we've been alongside the last year, it's truly been an honor. And we're really excited for the next chapter, which is kind of like an old chapter for us.
Yeah, we're going back to our old podcast, Truly Darkly Creepily, and you'll be able to hear us there every Friday. So you will still get your crime dose from your two, dare I say, third favorite hosts. I don't know your roster. I'm not going to be presumptuous and put us at the top, but I am going to say you're listening right now. So you like us a little bit for sure.
And on our other podcast, it's a little more loosey-goosey. We get a little of conversation of what's going on in me and Quinn's life, and then you get two stories per episode. So if you were listening to Crime of a Lifetime going, ugh, I wish there was more, have we got it in store for you at Truly Darkly Creepily. So after this last episode airs, which is the first Tuesday in August, that Friday, we're going to be coming out with a brand new episode of Truly Darkly Creepily. So please tune in there. We'd love to have you. Well, until then, you'll hear us on Crime of a Lifetime for the next two episodes. But should we
– this being – you know what, though? You'll hear us on Crime of a Lifetime today because we're about to tell you a pretty crazy story.
A pretty crazy story. Well, speaking of which, we have to ask. This sort of takes place around a restaurant service. And, Quinn, you have a lot of experience working in the service industry.
Oh, hell
yeah.
You
have a lot.
Regrettably so, but I've certainly served my time.
Good pun. You served your time.
You.
I like it.
I have a lot of friends that are Israeli. And you know, when you're Israeli, you have to serve in the Israeli army. And I was always saying that I think when you're American, you should have to serve in the restaurant industry for legitimately 2 years, just so that people have a common language and the ability to understand and cut their fellow server a break every now and again, because you just run into so much garbage when you're working there, garbage customers and garbage bosses. It is not a chill environment.
It becomes very clear amongst my friends or not. You know what I'm going to say? They're not my friends. I think in order to be my friend, if you want to be my lover, you've got to get with my friends. But if you want to be my friend, you have to have work in the service industry. I have not worked in a restaurant proper, but boy, have I catered. Have I bartended at a Broadway theater? Yes, I have done both of those things. And I've worked retail, which I think is very similar to the service industry.
I'm going to say, just having done both, that retail is rated G and working in a restaurant or a bar, it's rated R, folks.
People,
like, there's a lot of late nights. There's a lot of partying because when you think about it, the way that your lifestyle adapts to that is that you – stay up much later. Yeah. Your shift ends and you drink much more because you're drinking at the bars that are open late, or you're drinking at the restaurant or bar you're at once the doors close.
Which is dangerous.
And then you're sleeping in. It's not a healthy lifestyle. No. I don't recommend it. But I have lived it. And
you might be going back
to it.
Thank
God, unlike some of the people in this story, I lived to tell you about it.
I am, you know, I will say, this is what happens when you don't tip your servers. So let's launch into it.
I'm Quinlan Posner.
And I'm Carrie Ipama. And this is
Crime of a Lifetime.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, we should introduce you to our main characters. We have David and Dawn Vienz, and they live in Lomita, California, and they actually – well, David owns a restaurant. He owns the Time Cafe. And so on the night of October 18th, 2009, the two of them, Dawn and David, they're at their apartment, and they've had a tough week. I mean, owning a restaurant is no joke. It's a big deal. David's
stressful.
Putting in like 100 hours a week. He's dealing mm-hmm. with those, what is it? Those stiffers. What did I say? He's dealing with
cereal stiffers.
He's dealing with cereal stiffers. You know, life is tough. And so they want to let their hair down. They want to let loose. And Dawn goes, "Hey, David, I got a great idea. Do you want to do a little cocaine with me?" This is not the first time they're venturing into this world. Spoiler alert. Restaurants, I think they use a lot of cocaine. You know, you got to stay up late. You got to clean
it. In the food?
Not in the food. Absolutely. You're not going to waste it on the food.
One sprinkle of cocaine.
Move over. No. Salt. No, 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 no. listen.
Salt with an edge.
Listen, those cereal stiffers, salt with a little cocaine. What story is happening? What you need to know, David and Dawn, they're in their apartment. They're doing a couple bumps of cocaine to take the edge off because why not? David owns this restaurant. Dawn is his hostess. They're married. Let's get into it.
Well, I would say you said a couple of bumps, and I'm being presumptuous because I wasn't there.
You think it's lines.
But I'm picturing – I think it's lines. I'm going to take it a step further and say I think it's lines. Again, not uncommon in the service industry. But obviously, like, if you've had a stressful time doing cocaine – I wouldn't recommend it for taking the stress off your plate. I think that can amplify things. And in this case, it totally does. They get into a heated argument, and David accuses Dawn of stealing money from their restaurant. And Dawn's pissed. She's pissed at him. So this starts this huge fight. And they've already been kind of bickering throughout the day. So you can imagine they've got stuff maybe they didn't
fully
put
resolve.
Aside or get through. They didn't resolve it. And then they're on cocaine. And now's a great time to dive back in and resolve it while on drugs.
This sounds, I mean, again, as Quinn said, to take the edge off, we wouldn't recommend cocaine. But I got to say, too, in the middle of a day of arguing with your partner, you're going to sprinkle in a little cocaine? My God, probably not a smart decision. So according to David, what happens is Dawn is not letting up. She's wanting to talk about, she's wanting to address it, and she's not letting it go. And David goes, "Enough, I want to go to sleep." So he pushes his dresser in front of the bedroom door to keep her out. And then he pops an Ambien. I just want to say the FDA does not in any way approve of this story.
No.
God.
But I think it's very funny that you said they don't want to. She wants to address the problems, and he puts "addresser" in front of the door.
Intrigue.
And she is amped up, and hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. But it does, because it has a woman scorned and on cocaine. So she's superhuman, shoves this dresser with the door out of the way, and is like, no, we're gonna keep fighting. I've got a lot of fight left, and here we go. And David is now pissed because he's counting the hours till he has to get up and go back to work. He's gonna get like 4 hours of sleep at this point. So it's that feeling of desperation of like, I cannot keep talking to you about this. I absolutely need to rest. But don't worry, David has a solution.
Oh, God.
What is the solution, you wonder? Fairly obvious one. We've all been here before.
A little chamomile tea? A little chamomile tea and a nighttime meditation as a couple?
No, he's going to tie Dawn up.
Huh. Okay.
Like, what?
Took a turn.
Yeah, see, this is so, in all the fights I've ever been in
Never
with any
that.
Partner
Never
or person,
that.
I don't think either one of us has been like, I guess we'll just have to tie this person up. But this is what David decides to do. He ties Dawn up and puts duct tape on her mouth, around her feet, around her hands. And you're already thinking to yourself, who does this? The answer is David, because this isn't the first time he's done it. He's actually done this to Dawn twice before, and it wasn't even because they were fighting necessarily. He says that it was because he didn't want her driving around wasted, whacked out on coke, and drinking. So it was just like he was shutting down her night. He was like, I'm putting you to bed, and the best way to do that is not chamomile tea. It is duct tape. I mean, chivalry. Am I right, folks?
Well, they do say chivalry is dead, and I would say chivalry leads to death in this situation, because Dawn does not cry, does not scream or resist as he restrains her. He leaves her on the living room floor, and then that Ambien clicks in. We get like a little like lullaby in the background, and then like a little crow, a little hen. What is it? A little cock-a-doodle-doo moment? Uh-uh! There it is. The next morning, David wakes up. He goes, huh, totally rested after that nice little Ambien. He gets out of his bedroom. He walks in the living room, and there he sees Dawn. She is dead.
Well, I would say that having realized that Dawn is dead, David's got to be looking at his options right now, and it doesn't feel great to call the police and then try to explain why your wife that has duct tape on her arms, her feet, and her face is dead. Plus, they both have cocaine in their system. In fact, the reason that Dawn died is that she vomited from probably drinking and cocaine and not being able to breathe, and she had that duct tape on her mouth, so she choked. So what happens when David realizes this has happened, according to him, is that he panics. He does not know what to do. So the first thing he does is just grab her and push her into a closet. Then he's like, what am I doing? That's my closet. Takes her then and what's that going to solve? Puts her in a garbage bag and then takes it to the dumpster behind his restaurant. His wife is in a garbage bag in a dumpster. This is your wife, dude. What are you doing?
I just have to interject here. We've said it in like a lot of roundabout ways. To be clear, the only side of the story we have is David's. So I just, in terms of like that little salt, that kosher salt that he's throwing on his dishes, let's just all take a little piece of it while we hear this story, right? So
sure.
It's the next day. It's October 19th, 2009. And David, he's got a meeting. He's got things to do at his restaurant, The Time Cafe. By the way, because you can't see how it's spelled T-H-Y-M-E. So we love a pun.
The herb.
We love a pun. Now, David shows up to this meeting. He looks tired. He looks upset. And he enters this meeting saying, hey, listen, Dawn's actually not going to be working here anymore. No explanation, no reason. In fact, this young waitress who works here, this woman named Kathy, she agrees to take on all of Dawn's responsibilities.
What's David going to do now? He's got to start sort of spreading a story because people are like, where's Dawn? So he's like, oh, we broke up. She wanted me to get out of the restaurant industry, and she had this horrible drinking problem that she refused to get help for. And I got to say, a little bit pot calling the kettle, because last time we checked in on you, David, you were on cocaine, you had alcohol and Ambien in your system. So even though Dawn, this is true, she's got had a bit of a drinking problem. And in fact, David's daughter, Jackie, recalls that Dawn would secretly drink a beer when she woke up. Like, she'd wake up, go down to the kitchen, she's having a beer when most of us are having a coffee, and she'd just keep drinking the rest of the day. You know, I think she was just very unhappy and didn't know how to deal with her problems. It sounds like she had a lot of them, living with David being probably the primary one.
What's also important to note is that when David is telling this story, I think people knew that Dawn had a drinking problem, some substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. However, it was not like her to skip town. It was not like her to just disappear off the face of the earth. She had friends. She has family. She has people who love her and care about her. She had commitments that she made that suddenly it's just radio silence. She's not there anymore. So people are hearing the story from David, and it's just not adding up. It's like, oh, she was mad. Yeah. You wanted to get out of the restaurant industry. She could have broken up with you, but why isn't she coming over to my house? So people start to become suspicious of David's story.
So it is now October 20th, 2009, and Dawn is supposed to show up for something really important. Like you were saying, Carrie, she's missing all kinds of appointments, but this one is near and dear to her heart. She's supposed to be with her friend Karen while Karen goes to get cancer treatment. But she doesn't show up. She doesn't call Karen. So Karen's like, what is going on? This isn't her. I'm going to go check on her. So she goes to the restaurant. Of course, she's not there. And David is. And he is like, you know, covered in sweat, looking crazy, probably looking like a guy that does a lot of drugs and is a little bit
guilty. Sorry.
Agitated.
Agitated. I say guilty. You say agitated. Karen walks in and she immediately asks David, what's up? Where is Dawn? And David tells sort of a similar story. But if you'll notice, as David keeps telling people these stories, they become a little bit more embellished. It's just a little bit more and more information, different details. He tells Karen that him and Dawn had fought because Dawn refused to go to rehab, which again is different than what he said before, right? He said that she wanted him out of the restaurant industry. And then he says, you know, also I was mad at her because, you know, I suspected that she was stealing from the restaurant for a while now. So then he asks Karen, who, by the way, is like fresh off of chemo, fighting cancer, and he asks Karen to go through the receipts. And when Karen goes through the receipts, she finds a discrepancy of less than $25. And I gotta say, anyone who's worked in the restaurant industry, that's nothing. That's two appetizers.
It's also just a rude bluff.
Yeah,
because, you're bluffing, David, and then you made this poor woman
do your accounting
on chemo do math.
It's just
like,
rude.
All afternoon? That just sucks.
And so Karen then proceeds to ask more questions of David, right? She says, she asks, you know, did Dawn take her things when she left? Because she sees Dawn's car still in the parking lot right there in front of her eyes. And David then says, you know, that car isn't actually working right. It's actually not registered to Dawn. And Dawn did take some stuff. She took some luggage with her. He has all of the answers, but none of them seem to be adding up.
And he's staying, like I said, he was agitated
when
she walked in.
He's sweaty.
He's still agitated. He's like pouring sweat while he's talking to her and being like, I don't, like, you know, it's that like defensiveness that I think people, she's reading into it and she's like, this is weird. And at one point he's being dismissive, but he's like talking about Dawn and he's like, oh, good riddance. And it's that thing where you're like, good riddance? What do you mean good riddance? Like, where is she? What are you talking about? So 3 days later, she follows up and she's like, hey, any update on Dawn, David? And no one's seen her. Do you know what's up? And he's like, oh, I've talked to her. I've talked to her on the phone. I've talked to her via text. She's around. She just needs time away. And so Karen's like, look, fine, but I'm going to need to stop hearing that from you and hear it from Dawn. So next time you talk to her, tell me all I'm asking is that she call or text me because I'm worried.
And wouldn't you know it, Quinn, Karen gets a text later that very same day. What a coincidence.
Can you believe the time in?
Spelled T-H-Y-M-I-N-G?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes, that's right.
So
it's another pun.
It is from Dawn, and it's to Karen. And it says that she needs some time to think, you know, that she's moving back east and would call when she's settled and gets a new phone number. because no red flags there. But what's interesting about it is, you know, when you have a best friend, when you have someone you text all the time, you have shorthand, you know, you have things that you say or things that you do, whether it's emojis you use, I don't care what it is, but you just, and if someone else is texting you from that number, it just hits different. And Karen recalls how it had a bunch of spelling and punctuation errors, and that was very unlike Dawn. We imagined Dawn to like love a grammar, love a comma, love an Oxford comma. And the text, the most telling part of this text that she gets from, quote, Dawn, is that it's signed Love Pixie, spelled P-I-X-Y, which is Karen's nickname for Dawn. However, it's spelled incorrectly. It should be spelled P-I-X-I-E, which frankly is the only appropriate way to spell Pixie. And the fact that it's spelled wrong, it just, her blink goes off and this already fraught situation, she feels sick. It's not a good situation. She just doesn't feel right.
So look, at this point, Karen is suspicious. She's suspicious of where the hell her friend Dawn went, and she's got a pretty good reason to be. And also, I'd add that she's not alone. So we told you guys David and Dawn work at Time Cafe. It's in a strip mall, and there's a few other businesses there, motorcycle shop being one of them, that is run by a guy named Joe Kakasi. Joe, Dawn, and David were all pals, and they talk every day.
They're in the same business park.
Yeah, and they're next door neighbors. So they're like, hey, what's up? How's your motorcycles? Hey, what's up? How's your focaccia? I don't know.
I'm assuming Time Cafe does have focaccia, for sure.
I assumed so, too. Did not look at their menu, oddly.
Weird for you.
How
that's
unlike
weird
myself.
Weird for you.
Well, Joe knows what's on the menu because he goes all the time. So he could tell us about the focaccia. In fact, he goes enough that he and Dawn have kind of buddied up. And believe it or not, Dawn actually has a secret with Joe.
Wait a minute. Is it what I think it is?
No, it's not sexy.
Okay, that's boring.
It's
financial.
It's financial. Boring.
I knew that, but I thought it would be fun to trick our listeners. So it's a financial arrangement. And at some point over the summer, Dawn came to Joe's shop without David, and she brings with her $640 in cash in an envelope. And she asks Joe if he can store it for her. She calls it her little nest egg. It's like she's
very original.
Very, I don't know if you've heard of that phrase, nest egg. It's where you squirrel money away for just something big and extravagant later. But Joe doesn't really know what she wants to use a $640 in cash for and why she can't store it at home. But he says, sure, why not? So he agrees to store this money for her over the next several weeks. And as it turns out, the day before Dawn went missing, aka Dawn died, Dawn calls Joe. She calls him and she says, hey, could I come by the shop to store some more money? But of course, after this phone call, she never showed up. And Joe is going, that's weird. That's weird.
Yeah. He's like, what's going on? Where's Dawn? What the hell's up, David? And David's like, ugh, you guys ready for another version of what happened?
Let's get into it.
Here it is. Fired Dawn. Had to fire her for drinking on the job.
Which, okay.
Also, mishandling the money. And then she left.
I gotta say, drinking on the job, Quinn, you've worked in a restaurant. I've worked at a bar. Drinking on the job is part of the job. You fired her for something that everyone does?
It's in your job description.
Weird. Weird move.
No. No, and of course Joe doesn't believe this for a second. So he says that when this happened, he says, I'm just stunned. I'm thinking to myself, did you forget who I am? I'm over at your restaurant every night. Your wife's over here every day. This isn't flying. You're lying to me.
Also, you fired your wife? Could you imagine?
No.
I think it's impossible because it is. That's all I'll say. But also, the fact is, like, if she
because it didn't happen.
But also, it's like if she stored her money and left and she got fired from her job, Joe knows about this nest egg. Joe's going, why
but
didn't
David
she?
David doesn't.
Exactly. So Joe's going, I know she's got $640 now. And if she lost her job and if she was head out of town, you bet your bottom dollar, pun intended, she'd be coming over to my shop.
For her bottom dollar.
For her bottom freaking dollar. So it's been 2 weeks now since Dawn's disappeared. We've got, you know, Karen really worried. We've got Joe really worried. We've got David making up God knows what excuse with whoever asks him what's up. And
sleeping with Kathy.
Then he starts to sleep with Kathy. He starts dating that little Kathy who took over all the positions. You're welcome. Both right. at the restaurant and in the bedroom. And she's significantly younger. She's in her 20s. David is in his 50s. Kathy, I mean, listen, I like to think that you are just like a young, naive little lady. But girl, you know, this is like, really there's was. A lot of red flags here. And I think we've all been in our 20s. We've all made a mistake. But I'm going, Kathy,
Carrie,
girl,
red
out.
Flag is like the understatement of the century. She goes over to the house. And remember, Don has left.
Yeah.
He didn't get rid of Don's shit. So she opens the closet. It's like Don's clothes are in there. Don's stuff is
and
there.
And she's like, can I borrow like, pajamas from
so
Don?
Your wife,
like, yeah. Just going on.
Kathy, poor Kathy. She probably did say that. I like to think that when she looked around and saw all of Kathy's stuff was there, she starts scratching her head. Because I sure would. So at this point, David's life is getting a little off kilter if it wasn't already when he woke up to his tied up wife dead. You know, this is his fault. He's making all the wrong choices. And coupled with the stress of running a restaurant, having his neighbors, his friends.
All suspicious of him.
Everybody's like, wait a minute. Why is she gone? Things are just getting out of control. He needs help.
And
he can't do this alone.
And who do you call? Your daughter.
Your daughter.
You call your daughter from your first marriage, Jackie. He calls Jackie. She's, by the way, in South Carolina. They're in California. She's literally on the other side of the Americas, yeah. at the lower 48. And he calls Jackie and he goes, Jackie, listen, I really need some help. You know, Don and I, we got in a fight and Don had taken off for a few days. Which again, count them, that's story number 4. Jackie, being the good daughter that she is, she hops in a plane, she flies over, she's going to help her dad. She arrives in early November. And David then asks, I can't even, this one is shocking to me. Once Jackie is there,
so bad.
David asks Kathy, his new girlfriend, and Jackie to help him box up Dawn's clothes. You're asking your new
so
girlfriend
awful.
And your daughter to
and
pack
your daughter,
up.
To clean up your mess, literally.
Literally to clean up your mess. And he ends up showing them text messages from, quote, Dawn, where she says that she still loves David, but she isn't coming back. Which, knowing what we know, this part shocks me to my core, where this is like, I think David's a narcissist just on this alone, because the fact that Dawn, this fictional Dawn, because we know she's dead at this point, is texting David that she still loves him, but she's not coming back. And he shows it to his daughter and his new girlfriend. That is sick. That is gross. That is disgusting behavior. Right?
100%.
Like, knowing she's dead and you killed her, she's texting you that she still loves you? Get a life.
It's been 3 weeks, and on November 8th, 2009, Dawn's sister has had enough, and she files a missing persons report in L.A., and they start to investigate. So they're putting up flyers with Dawn's photo on it. They're going around contacting the local authorities and agencies. Missing persons detectives are looking through her bank, through her cell phone records. They're talking to family members. They're talking to friends. Feels like they might close in fast, because I know those family members and friends are feeling suspicious.
Well, and who's the first person you're going to interview in this situation?
Mm.
David, her husband. So just two days later, Sheriff Deputy James Dondas goes to David's apartment in Lomita, and he's there, and they're there to interview him, right? So David, you'd think at this point David would have told the story enough times that it would be consistent.
No, because he's told it different every time. He doesn't remember what he said last or first. Or
he says that him and Dawn had marital troubles because of her substance abuse issues. He says that they did fight on October 18th because she was mad at how much time he spent at the restaurant. Not about her going to rehab. Not about her stealing money from the restaurant. It's about as much time. It's about how much time he was spending at the restaurant. Interesting. We never know which is the truth. So the police are hearing this account and going, okay, do I believe you? You got in a fight with the person the day she disappeared. It's pretty obvious that he's got something to do with this.
Yeah, and he's been lying now for 3 weeks. He's sort of reaching a breaking point here because, like you said, he's not a person with a healthy lifestyle, right? And he's trying to keep a secret, trying to keep a pretty big secret, and he's roping people in. And we know he's somebody that is also trying to own a restaurant at this time. I mean, there's a lot of stress going on. It's a lot of chaos. And one night, David and Jackie, his daughter, are driving home from the restaurant. They're both drunk. Oh, Jackie is stoned from smoking weed. And David drunkenly just starts to cry. Imagine you're a little bit stoned and drunk.
And your dad's driving you stoned and drunk. Which is
right. Well, already get there, but then be like, what is your headspace to receive
your dad
what
crying.
Is about to be a new story, which is that David starts to cry, starts to tell Jackie, actually, Don isn't coming back. Don's not coming back ever. And he starts to tell her what actually happened on October 18th to Don.
And it's what we told you earlier in the story. Well, he tells her almost everything. He tells his daughter that he tied Dawn up and that she choked to death on her own vomit. And he insists that this all has been a terrible accident. He didn't mean to kill her. But he does tell Jackie that no one will ever find Dawn's body. It's never going to be found again. It's gone. And Jackie is taking this in. She's stoned. She's drunk. This is a lot, right? I can't imagine how that must feel to receive this information about your father.
Confusing.
It's really confusing. And, you know, she makes the choice to keep this secret, you know, to not go to the police right away. She says, I'm his kid. I don't want to see my dad in prison for the rest of his life. And I felt obligated to hide that secret for him.
I mean, he's put her in an impossible situation. This is your kid, and you're asking them to essentially break the law on your behalf.
Not like, essentially, to definitely break the law. This is like aiding and abetting after the fact.
Sure, a murder. And here's the truth, too. Like, she's already been helping him when she didn't know the story. Mm-hmm. She was packing up those belongings and getting rid of them and really like cleaning up evidence at the scene of the crime, which was their home. And she had dropped everything to help her dad, who she thought got left by his wife and was, you know, dealing with the restaurant and all this. It's like, sure, I'll come help you, dad. And now the real story comes out of like, I might have done a murder. And it's like, you know, I know he's putting it in the – he's putting the label of accident on it. But still, to receive all that and then, like, I don't know what you think, listeners, but if your parent
– Oh, I can't even –
told you this.
I don't think we can – it's like that is such an impossible thing.
You can't imagine it, of course, because most of us don't have parents where that would be a possibility. But it is a thing where I am not – I'm not going to condemn her allegiance to her father in this situation, because I do think that when this happens, your love for a parent or a child or a sibling will often outweigh justice or your need to seek it for someone that you weren't as close
to. I'm also curious of like what Jackie's relationship was with Dawn, right? I mean, I think what's crazy though is like not only does she receive this information, but it goes a step further, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, because she has to now help with the cover-up, really. Well, she doesn't have to, but she decides to. Ugh. She decides to help him. And she texts from Dawn's phone to hide the fact that Dawn is dead. She texts, this is Dawn. I'm okay. I'm in Florida, and I'm here to start over. Then after sending that text, she helps to get rid of that phone. So she becomes, in this moment, her father's accomplice.
So on December 9th, 2009, David is interviewed by the police again. And this time, they bring their little recording device so they can get him on tape. And at this point, the claims he makes about Dawn are ramped up, right? He says that she's drinking so much. He says that she's drinking like 18 beers a day, which is a lot of beers. In addition, her behavior is erratic. He says that she's yelling at people at the restaurant, the fellow staff. He's saying that she's causing cash shortages of $200 to $300 by miscalculating customer bills. He's saying that she's not dependable. And then he tells them the story about the day before Dawn went missing.
Right. And that on October 18th, 2009, what had happened, in his words, is that he left Dawn at home. He went to the restaurant. Then he went to a bar with a man that he was interviewing for chef for his restaurant. Then he goes home. Dawn's gone. Dawn comes home. He sees her again the next week. She's got, you know, she looks terrible. Her clothes clearly haven't been washed. She smells of booze. It's got Bender vibes. And she says to David, I want us to leave this restaurant business, leave everything behind and move to the mountains and, you know, grow time, not operate time. It's that vibe. And David is like, you got to get help. You got to go to rehab. And she's like, you know what? You're right. So 2 days later, she packs up and leaves town supposedly to do so. And that is our newest version of David's story.
And it's after she leaves the second time that over the next couple of weeks, David gets a couple of text messages from her. She calls him and they speak on the phone twice. And in one of the text messages, here we are again with him saying that she loved him. Dawn is saying that she loves David and needs some time to work things out. Again, I just have to highlight, he's writing these texts saying how much he's the author of this woman who he murdered, who he killed. And he's putting her last words saying that I love you. I got to tell you, if what he says happened, if she did choke on her vomit, I'm going to assume her last thought was, fuck you, I hate you, David, not I love you.
Look, the police, they're not buying what David's selling, obviously. Because even if Dawn, even if the story is the story he just told, why the hell wouldn't Dawn have talked to any of her friends after that happened? That's not adding up. And then Karen's talking to them and saying, look, this is a couple that used to fight. They used to fight all the time, and it was bad fights. In fact, my friend Dawn would go hide in the bathroom to try to keep safe and stay away from David.
Which, again, if we do have evidence of if we have evidence, we have stories, according to Dawn, of her having to flee David from the bathroom because of his violent temper. I don't know. I'm just calling into question the whole story in the first place that she died with a duct tape over her mouth. I'm just saying. But to your point, it's like she's telling this to her friend Karen, right? She's communicating this to Karen the whole time. So it doesn't make sense why Karen would be out of the loop in any of this conversation. Why Dawn would just leave her high and dry. And in addition, it's the same deal with the story that Joe Kakasi knows, right? Why would Dawn leave behind the hundreds of dollars that she has being stored there under his watchful eye? It's just not adding up, right?
No, yeah. But, you know, they don't have a body. It's been 10 months. They haven't seen Dawn alive. They haven't seen Dawn dead. So in August of 2010, the missing persons, they decide this is not a missing person. This is likely a homicide. Let's change it to a homicide investigation. And these new homicide detectives get a warrant for David's apartment. And they go in and they find bloodstains on the bedroom wall. Now, we don't know from even David's version where he, you know, let her get tied up and barf and she died.
In that version, the living room.
I don't see where the blood comes. Well, I don't see where the blood comes from is what I'm saying in that version. So I'm saying even to this day, every iteration we have of this story as told by David, I don't get the feeling we necessarily have the correct one.
No, I don't either.
What I do know is they see this blood and they cannot test it because it's been too long and these samples are going to be too degraded.
Well, and then a few months go by and they go, we got to talk to his daughter, Jackie, right? She must know something. But she's already moved back to South Carolina. I assume she helped her dad with the restaurant. She found out that he's a murderer and she's like, I got to get out of Dodge. I don't think this is a healthy, safe, familial environment for me. So she books it back to South Carolina. And so the police know that she was around. And you know what? It's a good bet because while she's being interviewed, she's not while she's going to defend her dad, but if anyone puts a little pressure on her, she's going to crack. I think she knows this is wrong. So she confesses to what her dad told her. She tells them everything she knows, and she totally cooperates with the investigation. And after she does, the detectives instruct her to call her dad and tell him that she told the police the truth.
The next day, which is February 23rd, 2011, David shows Kathy a local article about how the police are now investigating Dawn's disappearance as a murder. I don't know how much Kathy knows at this point, but I'd have been interested in being a fly on that wall when she sees that article. I just wonder what she's thinking when he's like, check this out, my name's in the paper. Like, ay, 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 Kathy, get out of there.
You know, when you're feeling anxious, I've never murdered anyone, so I don't know what would go along with that sort of anxiety. But mm-hmm. I have spoken ill about someone, so I understand feeling fearful. And so I have a feeling he sees this article, and it's like his anxiety and fear knows no bounds, and so there's no boundaries, and he just needs to talk to someone, and Kathy is there.
Well, I think he probably wants to bounce ideas mm-hmm. off her of, what do you think, what do you think, what do you think? Because the thing is, the police had a hand in this article.
Which
it's not wild. Just it's not just a journalist writing it. It's sort of them too, because they said, you got to write that we're closing in on a suspect and talk about how we found blood in David's apartment. And that was true. We just told you they found blood. But remember, it's too old to test. It didn't do him a bit of good. But that's not what the article says. It's this carefully placed piece of journalism to try to make David sweat, and now it's just pouring out of him.
Well, keep in mind, lest we forget, his daughter, the day before, called him and said, hey, Dad, I told them the truth.
Right.
So if, like, the walls are closing in, it is getting awfully claustrophobic in David's head. And after showing Kathy the article, he tells Kathy that he's sorry, which, frankly, I don't know if you... Why don't you be sorry to Dawn, not Kathy? But he tells Kathy that Dawn is not coming back. He tells her that he killed Dawn by accident. And then David and Kathy, they get into his car and he starts driving. He's crying. He's driving. This feels like a very scary moment. And the police are on him. I think they know he's out and about, and they start tailing him. Mm-hmm. They put their sirens on. They put their lights on. They try to pull him over, and he does not. He resists. He speeds away. And then David gets to this seaside cliff, a scenic overlook, and he stops his car.
He hops out of the car, though. He doesn't just stop. He, like, leaps out. And I think Kathy's like, what are you
What's
doing?
Happening?
Like, going after him. And he's walking over to the edge just saying sorry. And he's saying sorry again and again. And he's like, no one is going to believe me. Presumably meaning no one will believe this was an accident. And he says to Kathy, who's got to be really panicked at this point, tell my mom and my brother that I love them. And no sooner does he say that, and he throws himself off this 80-foot cliff. And Kathy says, the minute that I saw him jump over, that's when reality really, really set in, that this woman really is gone. And when I saw him jump, I thought to myself, oh my God, he's dead too.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
At David's funeral, the town is abuzz, right? We still don't have a body from Dawn, and here we have David. Psych. There was no funeral. And do you want to know why? Because David is alive. He survived an 80-foot drop off a cliff.
It's really crazy.
It's so crazy.
You did not see that coming.
I did not.
I didn't either. I mean, when you read that somebody leapt off an 80-foot seaside cliff, it is just not in the cards that they could have survived.
Well, he did. He did, because the police were right there and they called a rescue helicopter, which in my mind is too nice for him. But they call a rescue helicopter. He is taken to a nearby hospital. A local reporter tells CBS that he landed on his feet. So his legs were totally shattered and his hips were completely broken.
I do feel that this is an interesting karmic retribution moment of like, you just want to vanish and run away from this problem and you don't get to.
No.
You know? And not only that, but here's some broken hips. So he goes to the hospital. Detectives are like, guess what? We brought you a balloon. We'd love to talk a little more.
We bought you a balloon and a warrant. Here's a balloon.
And the balloon is a warrant. They got it specially printed and they handed it to him.
They have some Mylar balloons in that at the police station, just in case.
Mylar warrant balloons.
With your Miranda rights on one side.
It's David is going to talk because it seems like he's given up. He did just jump off a cliff. So now he's going to tell them the new version of October 18th, 2009, which is the same story you guys have heard several times by now. The one where they had a fight, she moved a dresser, he taped her up, she was dead the next day. And after telling this story, they charged David with Dawn's murder.
It's interesting because the police are interviewing after this life-shattering accident. No pun intended. Mm. Well, pun intended, I meant it. But you know, he's got to be hopped up on pain pills, medication, machinery. Like, I am curious of, like, the ethics of that. Can you interview
somebody?
Yeah, exactly.
Under the influence of some powerful
drugs.
Yeah,
are you mentally sound to withstand questioning, right? But the one thing that he doesn't answer in this case is, where is Dawn? All we know so far is you're never going to see her again. She's never coming back. No one's ever going to find her. But it's like, where is she? Where is her body? Where are we going to find her? And so about 2 weeks later, David ends up telling the police that he wants to talk to them again. And he wants to share more context to his story. And within that context, it's also what happened to Dawn's body.
Right. So he says to them when they come back, I realized Dawn was dead. I didn't know what to do, and I came up with this idea to clean the grease traps at the restaurant and to take that and commingle the excess protein in those units. Which,
this already sounds like someone hopped up on pain pills. Like, I can't even imagine. Like what? Does that make sense to you at all?
I don't understand science. I don't understand cooking. I'm really the wrong person to ask, but it does make sense to me that if you put someone's body in a 55-gallon drum of boiling water, weigh it down with weights, and cook it for a bunch of days, that maybe it's not going to be a body anymore. Like that, I don't think you need to understand those things to get that. And that is exactly what he's trying to say he did. He's saying that he mixed Dawn's remains with grease and other garbage, like restaurant debris, and then was just cooking it down and putting it in garbage bags and throwing it away. He says the only part of Dawn that he would still have is her skull, and he says he hid it in his mom's attic because he didn't know what to do with it.
Does anybody need a minute? Is everybody okay? I know that's a lot to unpack because, oh God, it's so gross.
I mean, is the restaurant in business while
he's doing
this?
That's the thing. That doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make any sense. What does it smell like in that restaurant if you're cooking a person?
It's 4 days. And as we know, money was tight in that restaurant. I mean, the next day we know he went to a meeting.
Did they shut down?
Well, the next day we know he went to a meeting with this upcoming chef. And so he just was boiling his wife's body while he's in this meeting, while he's serving other people food. It's just, it gives me such the heebie-jeebies, and it just doesn't totally make sense to me either.
I'm just like, I don't know if I believe him or not. But it's like we didn't find a body, so it's like, I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I have a hard time believing him because his story has changed. And in this situation, he's hopped up on painkillers, right? He's clearly in a lot of pain. 2 weeks does not solve a shattered leg and shattered hips, right? So you got to imagine that the painkillers are flowing. But according to police, he seems very clear-headed. But to make matters a little stickier and a little less believable is the police end up going to his mother's house to search her attic for this skull. And they never found the skull in his mom's attic.
That part's odd to me because here he is. It's such a horrible story. It's so disgusting. It's so upsetting. Who knows why he decides to tell them? But you've got to assume, oh, it must be guilt, and he really wants them to know what happened. But then, if the skull part's a lie, how do you believe the rest? And if he did know where the skull was, it seems like wouldn't be any more damning to tell them that.
Well, you also wonder, like, is he lying for his own self-preservation, or is he lying because the night in question where he killed Dawn, whether it was accidental or not, he was drinking on cocaine and he took an Ambien. To me, that is a recipe for a blackout.
Does he know what he did? Right.
We found blood. We don't know if the blood in the bedroom was related to her, was connected to this incident at all. But I got to tell you, those three drugs, I mean, that does lead to some memory loss. Like, if he's half asleep, if he's twilighting, like, if the coke is bringing him up and the Ambien is bringing him down, I feel like physiologically that it has to do something with your brain. And he could also have dreamed things. Like, I just don't totally trust this guy what I do know is he did have something to do with her death. I know he killed her. Whether it was a violent outburst or it was accidental, I don't know. Do I believe that he boiled her body down? That's what he says. But again, I don't think he's a reliable narrator.
In September 2012, David Vians is tried for the murder of Dawn Vians in a California courtroom. And in spite of that wackadoodle-doo, disgusting hospital bed confession, David's going to turn around and plead not guilty. What he says is, that was all BS. I was hallucinating. I had a traumatic injury. I was then on pills, and I didn't boil a body. First of all, her death was completely an accident. I had her tied up because I was looking out for her. I didn't want her to hurt herself.
Again.
I'm a good man.
The fact is you tied someone up, and if something happens and you've restricted them, that's on you, dude. That's totally on you, in my opinion. While David doesn't testify, who else does? We have Karen Patterson, who is Dawn's friend, who she missed going to chemo with. And we also have Jackie Vians, who is his daughter, who he confessed to as well. And so their testimonies alongside his prior taped confession is enough for the jury to believe that David didn't plan to kill Dawn, but he certainly is responsible for her death. So he is convicted of second-degree murder, which is murder, just not premeditated. One juror later remarks that innocent people just don't jump off cliffs, which I have to say, I agree.
I agree, yeah. And after the verdict, David fires his lawyer because certainly it's your lawyer's fault, right? David, you really stacked this mountain of evidence against yourself. And David's like, I'm going to just represent myself. Let's see how that goes.
Yeah, what does he tell
them? At sentencing, he says to the judge and to Dawn's family, no one loved Dawn more than he did. Her family is his family, which I really don't think they want to hear that from you right now, David.
No.
But he really wants to say it. He's like slamming his hand down on the table as he's making points. It just I feel embarrassed for him.
Do you think he showed the texts from Dawn saying that she loved him, the text that he wrote?
Look at these texts. She loves me. Look at the number of times
after she died that I texted myself that she loved me.
In the trial, we proved that was you.
Like, this guy, the fact that he's saying that no one loved Dawn more than he did, and then 2 weeks after her death disappearance, he starts dating someone at the restaurant too.
Like, he said good riddance.
He said good riddance. Like, and you know what? Maybe she did love you, but look what you did. Look what you did. If she did love you, it's worse.
You didn't love her.
It's worse.
You didn't
exactly.
Love her.
He's not convincing. I mean, I don't think he gets past this one bit whatsoever. Which is surprising to no one. He is not convincing in his own defense. He probably would have been better off keeping his lawyer employed. David is sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. all of which he's going to spend in a wheelchair because David Vians is permanently handicapped from jumping off that cliff. And this year, he is eligible for parole.
And if you guys have any thoughts about this sort of mysterious case,
well,
what do you think happened?
Do you believe him?
Do you believe David?
Do you, Quinn, but I'm asking you, wait, do you believe him?
Oh, that was to me. Mm-hmm. I just thought you were talking to listeners. Do I believe David? I do not. I do Same. Not believe him.
I do believe he was responsible, 1,000%.
Yeah, I think that he was hopped up on drugs, and I think that he I think he did do something to get rid of the body for sure, but I don't think even he necessarily knows what it is. And I think he's probably had a lot of nightmares and a lot of hallucinations, and I don't think he knows necessarily because he doesn't have any reason to hide it. He was found guilty. Telling people where they could find her body wouldn't harm him at this point.
What is surprising to me about this case, because we've covered cases in the past of – on our old podcast, we covered cases where they weren't tried because there was no body. And I think this is pretty rare to have a conviction, a case, a trial without a body. I think this is a very rare set of circumstances. And I think it just proves to how bad he is at lying and how, like, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that he did this.
Well, if you have something you'd like Carrie and I to know or some thoughts about this case, then please hit social media. Hit us up there with hashtag Crime of a Lifetime. And we've got two more episodes left. We hope you will join us. And then we will see you in the future at Truly Darkly Creepily.
And you can also follow Truly Darkly Creepily on Instagram. So please feel free to find us there. And we'd love to chat and connect and meet you on over on that podcast. Thanks so much, y'all.
Told you the story. Catch more gripping stories pulled straight from the headlines with all new original series and movies on Lifetime. And stream on the Lifetime app or on demand. Check out MyLifetime.com to find out what's airing, because it just might be the case we talk about next.
We used many sources in our research for today's episode. Among the most useful were the following: an appellate court document from People v. Vians and an episode of CBS News 48 Hours entitled Over the Edge. If you'd like to learn more about this story, we highly recommend you check out these sources.
Crime of a Lifetime is produced by Tanner Robbins.
Our associate producers are Hazel May and us,
Quinlan Posner
and Carrie Ipama.
Our sound designer and editor is Hansdale Shi.
Our senior producer is John Thrasher.
McKamey Lin is our supervising producer, and Jesse Katz is our executive producer. If you like what you hear on the show, please subscribe, rate, and review Crime of a Lifetime on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Copyright 2023, A&E Television Networks, LLC. All rights reserved.